Okay, we're going to, we can't officially start the meeting today. We'll do that tomorrow. We are, my understanding, recording this, aren't we? Oh, you called to order on, okay. It's called, the meeting of the Early Childhood and Youth Development Committee is called to order. Staff has said we can formally do that. And so I'm going to explain what we're going to do. We're going to take all of the, first, real quickly go through the bill. The department will do that. Then we'll go through the amendments the department would like and briefly explain them. Then we'll hear of other amendments. Then we'll take testimony on that. And then tomorrow we're just going to vote on it. So. So Jerry Kerber from the department, who is the inspector general, and I think after this year he'd probably go from a 3-star to a 10-star general after having to go through this. Mr. Kerber, do you want to just start and go ahead that way? And I think that's the only feasible way we can do this at this late date with limited time that we can. So,
okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Why don't you go ahead on that?
Okay, Mr. Chair, members, my name is Jerry Kerber, and I'm from the Department of Human Services, where I'm the head of the Inspector General's Office, within which the Licensing Division is located. And the Licensing Division deals with a lot of child care issues, certainly. We license about 11,000 family child care providers around the state and about 1,600 child care centers. This bill is the result of our doing a review of the deaths that had been occurring in family child care settings. We looked at deaths across the board in all child care, but what we found is over the past 10 years, there had been a pretty significant increase in the number of deaths that we were seeing. It had doubled from first five-year period to the second five-year period. And those numbers were almost all represented in family child care settings. Out of the 86 deaths that we had during the little 10-and-a-half-year period, 83 of the 86 were in family child care settings, and the other three were in child care centers. We looked at you know, how many kids are being served in relative to those two different types of program, and found that while there's, you know, on any given day in Minnesota, there are about 90,000 kids who may be getting family child care services and about 60,000 kids who might be getting family or child care center. So 60,000 in centers, 90,000 in family child care. And so there's like 1.5 times as many kids in family child care settings. But when we looked at the rates of the deaths, it was 28 to 1. 28 times as many kids had died in family child care settings compared to child care centers. And so naturally that's really where we focused our attention over the last year in trying to figure out what we should do by way of coming up with recommendations for the legislature to change where necessary family child care licensing standards. The first thing that we had done was ask the Child Mortality Review Panel to take a look at this. That's a group of people that's established in law since the early 90s, and what they do is they look at infant deaths or children's deaths in Minnesota on a case-by-case basis. And it's not all deaths, but it's any death that is somehow involved with a licensed program, one of our licensed programs. It's any death that looks like there may have been some kind of maltreatment related to it, abuse or neglect by the parents or somebody in the home. Or it's a death of a child who's somehow connected with the child protection system. So it's three groups of those three topic areas that something they review on a regular basis. So what we had asked them to do is, even though they had looked at all of these deaths individually, we asked them to kind of step back and look at them collectively now and see whether or not they had any ideas for how family child care licensing standards could maybe be adjusted to decrease the likelihood of some of these occurring as we go on. And they came back with a pretty aggressive list of recommended changes, and you no doubt heard about that or got some calls or emails from family child care providers about that. There were some pretty dramatic changes that they were recommending in there, not the least of which were things like changing the number of annual hours of training from 8 hours a year to 24 hours a year, decreasing the number of kids that any provider could take care of at the time, at one time, especially if they had any infants. There were some that were, you know, pretty severe in that they would have a dramatic impact on this service that we really have come to recognize as necessary in Minnesota. I mean, we need family child care. We have child care centers, but a lot of people are more or less, studies have shown, kind of priced out of that level of care. And so family child care tends to be a little cheaper. This is what occurs in people's homes. But also there are a lot of people who prefer family child care because it's a little more, some people perceive it to be more nurturing, and the family child care provider becomes almost an extension of their immediate family, and people talk in very warm tones about their relationship with their family child care provider. And so none of what we're talking about here is meant to kind of diminish the family child care as a profession, certainly, or anything in that regard. I mean, family child care providers, by and large, are wonderful, wonderful people. What we have seen, however, is that too often that moment when the family child care provider is putting an infant down to sleep, they're not doing it according to how they're supposed to be doing it. And so of those deaths that we saw, 65 of them, or 75% of the total, were in represented situations where there were violations of the safe sleep requirements. And so there are some basic things that are required for putting an infant down to sleep in a family child care setting, in any setting, but certainly family child care, and that the infant has to be on its back, there should be nothing else in the crib with it. What we tried to do is to look at the licensing standards so that we could identify those things that are going to be more supportive of that moment of when that provider is putting those infants down. And so we came up with a number of different proposals that were in the governor's budget bill. And I think you know that this is in Article 3 of the governor's proposal. And none of that got included in Representative Huntley's bill, but my understanding is that there might be some opportunity here to really get some of that back in.
Maybe I can explain. I've talked to Representative Huntley on this, and he's looking at considering Sections 11 through 18 and things involved with that, basically child care safety. And so, as I suspected, I couldn't get a hold of him until this morning, but 19 through the rest of the bill is more with regard to teens, and we're not going to deal with that this morning. We just don't have time to get into that.
Okay,
that's so wrapped up with huge costs that it wouldn't go anywhere. So go ahead.
That's a good point, Mr. Chair and members. So what we're talking about here today, the bill itself is like 81 pages long. We're starting really at Section 11. And Section 11 begins, I believe, on page 8. So it's a subset of that bill that's pages 8 through 20, I believe. Maybe 8 through 19. Yeah. 18, actually. So, at any rate, I'll just walk real quickly through what the different sections do, and then, as you know, there are a number of different amendments, and the bill has gotten, it had a number of hearings in the Senate, and it picked up a few amendments in the Senate, and all of the changes that were adopted in the Senate are represented in some of the amendments that you have before you. And then there's some other amendments here, too. But I think there's a total of about 20 amendments or so. So just I'll go through the bill quickly here.
Yes,
and go through the sections. Section 11 is a provision that clarifies that if the department issues an immediate temporary immediate suspension against a family child care provider for violating one of the safe sleep requirements, the standard that's already in the law is that there has to be imminent danger represented, and that's what requires the department to take an immediate action. And so those licensing sanctions are the most serious we have, and the provider is immediately shut down, they have an expedited appeal right, certainly an expedited hearing right, but they're closed from that moment on. And the argument is that, but for our action, harm was imminent. What we're proposing in the bill is to make it more clear that in order to demonstrate that harm, we don't need either an injured or deceased infant to make that case, how the harm is imminent. The second section is Section 12, and that's one where it starts to, it reflects some changes in terminology that we're making regarding sudden infant death syndrome and shaken baby. SIDS death, sudden infant death syndrome, is a medical diagnosis that's made after the fact, after everything else has been ruled out. What we're changing here in our licensing law is the terminology.
Is this all the Patty Fritz language?
Her bill did not change the terminology. But there we will be getting to a section that does duplicate what she did.
Okay. Go ahead.
So we're changing sudden infant death syndrome to sudden unexpected infant death, and changing... Well, that's what Section 12 does. It requires a physician's order. Oh, Mr. Chair, you're correct. This is a section that requires a physician's order. If a provider is going to deviate from putting an infant on its back, the law currently says that a parent can give that permission for an infant to sleep in a position other than on its back. And what we're proposing to do here is to change that to a physician order.
Okay, we've already heard and passed her bill.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. The difference between this language and Representative Fritz's language is that in our language we say a physician. In her language she says a doctor. And we were seeking a little bit more clarity there, so we're not talking about somebody with a PhD in economics, for instance. We're really looking for a medical doctor.
So you mean I, with a Juris Doctor, I can't do that?
Mr. Chair, we can make an exception for attorneys. Maybe.
They are.
There's a provision in here that says that, and this is after much discussion with providers, that even though it's a requirement to put an infant on its back, we all have to recognize that sometimes infants are capable of rolling over on their own. And so the expectation isn't that you have to watch an infant that's on its back all the way up to age one, and every time it rolls over onto its stomach, you get in there quickly and roll it on its back. But we tried to acknowledge that here, that if an infant is capable of rolling over on its own, it can be left rolled over. There's an amendment that makes that more clear, that when we talk about amendments, we can get to that. We also are clarifying in here issues regarding when an infant has to be moved to a crib. When we began working on this issue with providers, one of the things that we heard most consistently is that there's a lack of consistent interpretation of what the requirements are for providers, that there was variability within counties and certainly across counties, and it almost had more to do, what the requirements were in some cases had more to do with what the licensor believed to be the interpretation versus what the state was saying. And so one of the things we recognized is that we hadn't been necessarily very clear in our communications with providers as we had in the past. We used to do training of family child care providers. Training of family child care licensing staff at the county. So maybe I should step back here just a second and explain this process. The state issues licenses to all child care providers, whether it's centers or family child care. But for family child care providers, where it's provided in their own homes, the counties do the monitoring. That responsibility and some authority is given to county staff for that monitoring activity. But when it comes to a licensing sanction, again, it's the state that issues the sanction. So we issue the licenses, we take away the licenses, and we issue the sanctions in between. But counties do the monitoring and issue correction orders. And so there are several hundred county licensing staff. With budget reductions over the last few years, unfortunately, one of the things that we stopped doing is training county licensing staff. And so in the absence of our providing kind of clear direction, you know, people being creative came up with their own interpretations. And so what we're left with is some variability on some of these very important issues throughout the state. And so what we were committing to in the bill overall is to reinstating that training requirement over counties, that we would do the training of counties. But also, wherever possible, we will seek clarity to some of these issues in the statutory language itself. And so that's where some of these things appear to be quite detailed about how you're going to handle infants, and that's not by accident. So this is one where we talk about if an infant, the expectation is that infants will be put to sleep on their back in a crib. Well, what happens if we're out for a walk and the infant falls asleep in a stroller? Well, naturally, being reasonable people, we would not say that you then either need to wake the infant up or go immediately home and put it in the crib. You know, I mean, these are kind of natural experiences, or if a child falls asleep in a car. However, some people were being told that. And so what we're trying to do is make it clear in the law here that the infant should be put in a crib on its back to sleep as soon as practicable. But in the meantime, the infant should just be continuously supervised by the provider. Make sure that they have visual supervision. Similarly, if an infant is being held and falls asleep, I know this is kind of getting into that level of detail, but because of the variability in how this was interpreted, some providers were of the understanding that if they were reading, for instance, to a group of children sitting on the floor and holding an infant, as soon as the infant fell asleep, they either had to wake the infant or go put the infant down. You know, that really wasn't really what the intent should be. So this is just saying that, you know, if you're going to hold a sleeping infant, that's okay, but you have to take into account the other duties you have, because you might have 11 other kids you have to supervise. And so you have to be wary of the fact that you need to meet the supervision needs of the other kids.
Mr. Chair? On that line, what about carrying an infant in a carrier in the front of your body, or it's a natural place to fall asleep and to continue doing work with the baby in front?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lane, that's a good question. The standard is that what would be in the bill here is that it's still expected you put an infant down as soon as practicable. But if you're going to be holding an infant, and then we'll get into the discussion about whether is that holding a sleeping infant, maybe it is, as long as the infant's airway is not blocked and there's nothing covering its head, then it can be done as long as they're considering the needs of the other kids in care. So we don't specifically mention that, but maybe, you know, we'll be back at some time to talk about carriers.
Just a quick question, Ms. Carver. So as we sit and have this conversation and I hear I hear the term reasonable and interpretation, It seems like there's a whole lot here that we're suddenly throwing on people and trying to limit their interpretation. And is what's going to go in this bill, is that going to eliminate the gray areas, and are we going to now be able to have our children with zero sudden infant death because of this statute?
Mr. Chair and Representative Kreskin, I think it, you know, we're never going to eliminate all the risk, obviously, and we're not going to eliminate all the gray areas, certainly, but we're, you know, these are some of the major ones that were brought forward to us during our conversations. We thought, well, through conversations with providers, I mean, that's where a lot of this sort of the specificity is coming from our working out some of this language with providers. And one of the other things that we had committed to, now whether it'll actually make it into the bill in the end, was that we were in our commitment to putting out more consistent messages to licensors and family child care providers. We're looking at sort of a web presence where it could be like Ask the Commissioner. So if somebody has a particular situation where their county licensor is telling them one thing and they think it sounds funny, they could ask the question, and then we'll post the question and we'll post the answer. And then that would be an answer to be viewed throughout the state. And so, and for parents as well, if parents have questions about, you know, is this right? Should my provider be able to do it this way? You know, it's quite a commitment on our part, but that's one of the things that was in the original bill that we would be doing.
Okay. We're not going to take any more questions. We're going through the testimony because we have to get that through. And then we want to have the chance for providers to testify also. And then we'll go to questions. So that's why we're going to do this. should have.
Actually, Mr. Chair, thank you, because that was going to be my question, because I've been writing down a whole host of so I wanted to ask you when we were going to be able to open up the salvo here, and we're going to hold check fire until the end. I'm good with that.
Well, see, Representative Kreischer gave me a chicken drumming the other night when we were at dinner with you too, and you didn't, so he got the question.
And thank you, Chairman. I appreciate you acknowledging me.
I'll just remember that when the hot sauce comes around.
Mr. Kerber, go ahead.
Okay, Mr. Chair, maybe in order for to get to this, maybe I can really kind of hit on what the biggest of the issues are here, the biggest of the changes.
Went through it kind of quick, like a lot of these things don't seem to be changing a lot. It's just terming them different.
Right, Mr. Chair, there's a lot of terminology changes, as I mentioned, from shaken baby to traumatic brain injury, and then...
looks like page 11 is the next substantial change. Is that correct?
Yes, Mr. Chair. One of the big changes is section 13, where... What we're proposing is that when an infant is sleeping in family child care settings, that the license holder be required to check on that sleeping infant every 15 minutes for the first 4 months of care. During that first 4 months is when the largest percentage of infant deaths has been occurring. And this is one of the things that's required in child care centers.
Mr. Kerber, just one second. I think you said section 13, but I think you're talking about section 15.
I'm sorry. I meant to say 15, Mr.
That's
Chair.
What I
yeah.
thought.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, that's section 15.
Okay.
In child care centers, the staff person either has to be with the infants continuously, or if they're not, they have to be checking on them every 15 minutes and then have a monitor so they can monitor what's going on, either a video or auditory monitor. So we're trying to replicate that in family child care settings, but only for the first 4 months of care, and that we were requiring that the license holder actually check on a sleeping infant every 15 minutes. It's either the first 4 months or if an infant has some kind of respiratory illness that they would also check on them there. And thereafter, be checking on the infant once every half hour. There will be amendments to that effect coming up in the Senate. What they did is they modified that to say it's not required, but the providers are encouraged to do this kind of thing. So that was one of the big ones. The next one is section 16, which talks about liability insurance.
I'm sorry, Mr. Kerber, what about the audio?
Oh, excuse me, Mr. Chair. Yes, I'll go back to that. So the audio, the subdivision 2 of section 15 talked about on either having, also requiring, if you're not continuously with that child, that you need to be monitoring the child either with an audio or visual monitoring system of some sort, so that there is a continuous oversight. That too has gotten amended so that it's recommended but not required. Again, that was kind of following the child care center situation. Then, Mr. Chair, section 16 is where we get into the liability insurance. Under the current regulations, providers are expected to have liability insurance. It says that they're required to, but then it says, but if they don't, they have to tell the parents if they don't. What we were proposing originally in the bill is that providers must all have liability insurance. And there's kind of two reasons for that. One was we had a number of cases where we had infants, over time infants have been injured or have died in family child care. And then it was after the fact that the parents found out that there was no liability insurance. There was one case where the parents were trying to recover burial costs and they couldn't get the burial costs for that case. When they signed up for the child care, the provider had insurance, but she had let it lapse and she hadn't informed them as she was required. So what we were requiring in the bill is introduced is that liability insurance be required of all providers. Then there will be certainly an amendment that will talk about the changes that. After that, the next couple pages are again more conforming amendments to the terminology change. But there are some changes in the amount of training that we're seeking here. For the sudden infant, sudden unexpected infant death, and
are we now on page 13?
Mr. Chair, if we're looking at section 17, all
12.
Oh, I see. Every year from 5 years.
Yeah.
Sorry. Yes, Mr. Chair. What we're changing here is for shaken. I'll just call shaken baby and SIDS training. Right now, the requirements are that you have this is a half hour training, and you're required to have it once every 5 years. What we're saying is that this is really pretty crucial, and that so this is changing it, not increasing it in length beyond a half hour still, but saying that this is an annual training requirement. That we think it's important enough in the SIDS trainings where they emphasize the need to put infants down to sleep correctly in their crib with nothing else present. And then the shaken baby is training that's got a component to it that's that helps providers deal with the frustrating moments that they're having while caring for infants. It's not, you know, shaken baby should be simply don't do it. It should be three words long, and it doesn't, you'd think we don't need that much to say about it. But the reason people do shake infants, unfortunately, is because they tend to be at the end of their rope. I mean, you've got a lot of kids with a lot of needs, and you've got a screaming infant, and unfortunately, shaking that infant quiets it down. What this is also about is the...
Mr. Chair, thank you. Mr. Kerber, shaking a baby does not quiet the baby down, what you just said.
Mr. Chair, Representative Franson, I've read that. I stand corrected. I haven't done it, but my understanding is that's kind of what motivates to do this.
Right, but by shaking a baby certainly doesn't quiet the baby down. Okay.
Just
to let you know.
Okay.
Mr. Kerber, I was wondering if you were thinking of having this kind of training for people frustrated by having to deal with legislators.
Does it quiet them down?
That's why it's worse. Go ahead, Mr. Kerber.
So to the extent that kind of training, though, helps people deal with those frustrating moments, I think what we've also come to learn in looking at some of these infant deaths is that infants who are put down on their stomach may find comfort sooner. If you've got an infant that's really pretty distressed and you lay it on its back in a crib with nothing else around, it may take a while for that infant to calm itself. But if an infant is put on its stomach sometimes, or maybe with a special toy or blanket that's comforting, sometimes they quiet down faster. And so the training, hopefully, here is going to emphasize alternative ways to deal with the stress that the provider is feeling at the moment. So that's kind of the connection there. The other areas where we're changing training is the child growth and development and behavior guidance training. Currently, there's a requirement that there be 2 hours of that training a year on child growth and development. And what we're wanting to do is to add to that and behavior guidance, again, to focus on dealing with those frustrating situations, and increasing that training amount from 2 hours to 4 hours. And actually, that would be one of the trainings that's required before a child care provider could get a license, that they have to learn a bit about how to deal with these situations. First aid training, Mr. Chair, members, right now there's not a requirement that it's ever repeated, and we're saying that first aid training should be repeated every 2 years. And CPR training, under the current law, I believe it's every 3 years, and we're changing that to every 2 years. Yes, that's on page 14.
114.6.
Yes, Mr. Chair. And in some of these cases, it was disturbing that when a provider found an infant not breathing, 911 wasn't the first call they made in too many cases. They would call the parents. They would call other people. They'd call their husband. And so, you know, that's kind of where we're focusing on some of the first aid and CPR training, where it really gets drilled into people that the first thing you do is call 911. We're clarifying here, too, that the training on CPR has to be involving the techniques with infants and children. And so it isn't necessarily that worthwhile to have a CPR training where you only practice on adult mannequins and not have a focus on infants and kids. And then we're also saying that this has to be an in-person training. Right now, people can get CPR training online only and without the demonstration component. And so what we're saying here is that it has to be either by the American Red Cross or the American Heart Association, or some other recognized evidence-based training provider, and with always the hands-on component. The rest there, then, and again, then as you proceed down on page 14 is where we change the training amount, as I mentioned, from once every 5 years to once a year. For CPR and shaken baby, and then there are other training requirements that exist for child passenger restraint systems, where before you transport a child, you have to learn how to really use a car seat correctly. There have been a number of documented injuries throughout the nation, but we're not changing that. That is not part of our issue here. But training has to be repeated every 5 years. Then when we get on page 16, what we're proposing here is that the overall training hours for providers be increased from a required 8 hours a year to a total of 16 hours a year. That mortality review panel that I mentioned was recommending 48 hours a year, but we're really looking at 16. What we took a look at is, what are the training topics that we think providers ought to have, and how is that, you know, what does that come closer to? And so 16 hours of training a year is a doubling of what's expected now, but it's still, we believe, to be reasonable. And then the last section, there's some technical amendments, as you see along there, going, changing the word includes to including, but the last area is on page 17, where we are proposing the development of a supervising for safety curriculum that would be developed by the department. And what this would be dealing with is all the supervision issues for family child care providers. And before getting a license in the first place, a prospective provider would be expected to get 6 hours of training on that, and then afterwards it would be 2 hours a year repeat. So, Mr. Chair, those are pretty much the provisions in the bill.
Okay, thank you. Now, why don't we take the amendments that you would like to see go on, and then we'll let other people. My understanding of going through this is the first one, we'll start from the mail call. The first one of yours is 07, is that correct?
Mr. Chair, yes. The first one of ours is 07. And I believe most of these, none of these amendments would be new issues to any providers in the room. These are things that we've talked about extensively in meetings and or they've been already amended into the Senate language. But the first one talks about that when an infant is capable of rolling over on its own. We had some further discussion with the Minnesota SID Center that we have to be careful that if we're making a point of saying that you have to put an infant down on its back in a crib, and as long as it can roll over on its own, you know, you don't have to go in there and flip it back again. And they're saying, well, hold on here, you know, you should slow down a little bit on that. And ideally, the infant is going to be at least 6 months old, or there's some verification from the parents that this infant is rolling over on its own at home. Infants roll over on their own at all different at all different ages. And so this is just saying that if a parent says, gives some kind of a statement saying, yes, my infant is rolling over on its own at home, then it's going to be okay.
So the SIDS Center wants that one?
Mr. Chair, yes.
And eight, I believe, is yours.
Mr. Chair, members, eight is again providing more clarity on the issue of what both what can be in a crib and what's a tight sheet. We spent a fair amount of time talking about these kinds of things, and some of this it incorporates some of the changes that Representative Fritz's bill had. Representative Franzen had an amendment to Representative Fritz's bill that talked about that the sheets fitting overlapping the underside of the mattress. That's incorporated in this as well, so that this is just really trying to make it much more clear. And that, and instead of saying, Mr. Chair, under the current law, it says all the things that can't be in the crib with an infant. And what we got back from providers was pretty consistently saying, well, why don't you just say what can be? You can have an infant and a pacifier. And so that's what we did here.
You did something logical. Nine. That's
nine. This 09 is also language that was included in Representative Fritz's bill, and I believe it was Representative Franzen that brought this up. We had a lot of conversation about what is an infant, and what an infant is you're an infant until you're 1 year old, but the language in the law said you're an infant through the 12th month. Somehow people were interpreting that to mean 13 months, and so because there's been variability, this is a good attempt to say that if you're younger than a year old, and everybody knows when an infant's a year old, then you're going to be classified as an infant.
And number 10, I guess, is yours also. We get into my research.
Mr. Chair, number 10 is dealing with swaddling, and swaddling is an issue that came up in all of our discussions about safe sleep requirements, and if we are in fact committed to bringing more clarity to what's permitted and what's not permitted, that we ought to address swaddling was basically the argument. Right now our department doesn't permit swaddling, but I think you will hear from some providers that they do swaddling. And there may be some variability in what is permitted as it relates to swaddling throughout the state. And so what this language represents is communication again with the Minnesota SIDS Center about if we were to allow swaddling, what would be the conditions under which we could allow swaddling? And so it's important to note here that when we're talking about swaddling, we're talking about a swaddled infant in a crib. There's nothing to say that you can't swaddle an infant, and you know, it's when you wrap them up in a specific way where their arms are tucked in but their legs are not too tight, and there's nothing covering their face, that you can hold a swaddling infant. Absolutely. This is only as it relates to when you put that infant down who's swaddled. And some of the issues that arise from that, if it's not done correctly, infants can overheat. Their legs won't develop correctly because their legs are too bound together. There may be hip dysplasia. If the blanket gets loose that they're swaddled in, then they can have asphyxiation issues with the blanket. And so this is trying to get at the swaddling issue as best we could by saying that if the parents are okay with it and the physician is even okay with it, and it's stepping out there a little bit to get the physician involved, but if people are believing that their family child care provider should be swaddling their infant, then it's all they have to do is just get a note from the physician saying it's okay, and we'll provide the form for their doing that.
Mr. Kerber, first of all, I never realized it was so much to swaddling until I started researching it yesterday afternoon. And you said their hands or arms are tucked in. Some methods, they say it's okay to allow their hands free. So there's different ones. But okay, so the SIDS Center, they would like this one.
Mr. Chair, if we're going to permit swaddling, this is language that they would be okay with.
Thank you. Then 11.
The A11 amendment.
This is yours, I guess.
Mr. Chair, yes. This is one that also, I think this was another Representative Franzen. I think she brought this up in a previous committee. I think it was, I'm not sure to what bill it got amended. But I think it was our department bill, in fact. Yeah, it was our licensing bill. This is another one of those areas that was just calling out for clarity. The regulations right now say that you have to use a bleach solution to clean diapering areas. Those regulations were written in the early 70s. And certainly we all know that there are a lot of products on the market now that are capable of disinfecting things. But there's also a lot of controversy regarding those different products. This is language that was identified from the Hennepin County public health folks, but then it's also got a little amendment on the end that was added in the committee about triclosan derivative and their derivatives and how that's it's a common disinfectant, antibacterial thing that can have some adverse effects. So this hopefully will help deal with a lot of the challenges that family child care providers have around the state in trying to come up with alternatives for what they can use as opposed to bleach. Sometimes counties will say, yes, it's okay, you can use this product or that product. In Hennepin County, you can get a variance to the licensing standards if you follow essentially these requirements. So we're saying, here, if we stick it in the law, then it's okay and people can stop talking about it.
Well, Mr. Kerber, because this is an issue I was going to have hearings on if we had time, but I just want to make sure that there's some kind of a clearance. There is an association of safe cleansers nationally, and the Underwriters Laboratory now is doing a lot of testing on children's cleaners. And not cleaning children, but cleaning things that not soaps, but I'm just wondering if we need to keep up with where their research is going sometime in the future. So maybe you should look at something like looking into those approvals.
Mr. Chair, that's a good idea. On line 9 and 10, it recognizes that these products have to be registered with the Environmental Protection Agency. So that there is some oversight of this on an ongoing basis.
Mr. Kerber, from what I'm hearing at conferences I've been to, that's not enough.
Okay. Okay.
Okay. So maybe you can look into some other language. Then number 12, I believe, is yours also.
Mr. Chair, the A12 amendment is merely saying that when we're talking about monitoring an infant, we're really referring to a sleeping infant, and so that if you don't have to check on an when we're talking about checking on an infant's sleeping infant, we didn't insert the word sleeping in there, and so other times if you're with an infant, it doesn't mean you have to be checking on them every 50 minutes because they're going to be with you. So this was kind of clarifying.
I believe it's 15 is yours.
Mr. Chair, yes, number 15 was an issue that was brought to our attention when I talked about the new training that's going to be developed. It isn't that the commissioner necessarily has to develop all the new training. The commissioner can also approve of other people's training that gets developed. And so the word "or approved" in there was something that brought some comfort. So that's a good one.
Then 16 is yours also.
And 16 is a good one, Mr. Chair. This just makes it clear that I mentioned that we have some new training that we're developing for strategies for managing behavior in kids. That's just here being added to a list of annual training options for providers to pick from. So this is a good one.
17, I think, also yours.
17 is some language that we helped draft to make it a couple of things more clear. One is that the state is really sponsoring some training that's provided by the Minnesota Center of Professional Development for Child Care Providers. And so we want to make it clear that if that's the training we're talking about, that it's going to be okay. There have been some cases where people have gone through the training that was actually, supported by the state, but it was being interpreted as not meeting the licensing requirements. So this is really getting at that issue. And then the second part of that, Subdivision 11, is one that goes along with the funding requirement. As I mentioned, that we had really stopped providing, the state had stopped providing training of county employees. And this is just saying that the department would have an affirmative responsibility to train county licensing staff on the interpretation and intention of all of these new requirements so that before they start enforcing them, it's really clear on what's intended here, whether if there is still some remaining ambiguity. And that we would not be required to impose any sanctions until after we've done that training.
Okay. Then,
and Mr. Chair,
I'm not sure if you had decided.
I think the A18 and the A19 were not ours.
Right. 20, Mr. Chair. I think. Is not yours, but
the A20. I'm not sure if this might be the same language as was in an earlier amendment talking about. Oh no, we haven't talked about that, Mr. Chair. Excuse me. This is an amendment that changes the way we deal with the liability insurance that I mentioned. In those cases where we found that the provider did not have liability insurance. Because they had let it lapse. This is an amendment that tries to deal with that specifically without requiring every family child care provider to have liability insurance. So what we were saying is that every provider must have liability insurance, and you must post us the certificate of insurance someplace in a prominent location in the house so that the parents of kids in care can see that, yes, in fact, you have liability insurance. What this amendment does is it gets rid of that new across-the-board requirement for liability insurance and says instead that notice that they give to parents about whether or not they have insurance has to be more specific. And so it has to include the date of the expiration of that policy. And so then at the date that the policy expires, they have to give a new notice to the parents. I believe that's what this one does.
Mr. Chair, I believe Mr. Kerber is referring to the A14 amendment. There's a very similar amendment that's A20.
Oh, yes, Mr. Chair. Ms. Aves is correct.
Is A14 in Department 2? Mm-hmm. Oh, is it A21?
Yeah. So what, maybe Ms. Aves can explain the difference between the two.
Mr. Chair and members, the A14 includes what Mr. Kerber had talked about, that if the policy expires, the license holder must provide new information to the parents. The A20 does not include the information about the expiration dates and the notice of dates. And that just strictly the A20 talks about providing notification of the change in the insurance status. There are more details and more requirements placed on the providers in the A14 than there is in the A20.
In either case, it's my understanding the department is not supporting either of these.
Mr. Chair, I think the department's position had been that we could accept the A14 language as an alternative if it's the will of the department. The A20 goes a little too far. What we really want is parents to know that when an insurance policy is even going to be lapsing so that they can act at that moment. So if the liability insurance is very important to the parent, that notice that they get from the provider will have the date that the policy is going to expire. And as Ms. Aves said, that's kind of the difference here. And so then at that point where the policy is either renewed or allowed to lapse, the provider is responsible for updating the parent on what happened. Did I renew my policy or did I let it lapse? That's the difference.
Either one requires notice to the parent that there's no insurance if there isn't. Is that...
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, initially, they're both requiring that.
Okay. So 21, then? I think this is just a short part of a previous one that you
I think
wanted.
So.
Mr. Chair, yes.
Shortened A17, I believe.
Mr. Chair,
it just
yes.
doesn't have subdivision of 11 from A17.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. Okay. And the other thing that the A21 does is that, remember I mentioned that we were proposing an increase in the annual training hours from 8 hours a year to 16 hours a year. And so the first parts of the A21 amendment kind of reinstates that 8 hours a year.
So you would oppose this?
It wouldn't be our first choice, Mr. Chair.
That's a way of saying it. Okay, we're to 20. 22, I know, isn't yours. 23, I'm not sure.
Mr. Chair, the A23 is the other part of the A17 that we mentioned that requires that the commissioner train county licensing staff on the new regulations before they would be effective or before they would be enforced. So it's really incorporated into the A17.
So then 24.
The A24, Mr. Chair, I believe it changes one of the training requirements. This was not one that...
It goes from 1 year to 2 years.
Right.
The SIDS training.
And I think that the training that's being discussed here is on page 14, line 30, is the SIDS training.
Right.
That we are proposing that half-hour training be every year, and this is changing that to be every other year.
So I assume you'd oppose this one. Or?
Mr. Chair, we would prefer that to be, especially the SIDS training where it's emphasizing putting the infant down correctly, we would really like that to be every year.
Okay. 25. I think you said that's like an earlier one. Maybe in the
A25 is again on the topic of swaddling, and it's
I think it's regarding
it's
pacifiers.
Plus, I think on
the sleep sack.
1.8 is when it gets into permitting a one-piece sleep sack,
right?
And with wings, and the with wings is the important part here, because there are sleep sacks without wings and there are sleep sacks with wings, and the wings issue is really for purposes of swaddling, and I've seen the demonstration, and maybe we'll see one today, but it allows the infant to kind of more or less. They've been described as a mini straitjacket, but we don't want to think of them that way. But there's some kind of a, there's wings on it.
Mr. Chair, if I may, for those of us that have other committees out, when are we going to get an opportunity? Because I'm going to not have an opportunity to ask the right questions. Will the testifier be back so we can ask the questions at another hearing?
No, we're going to take all of the questions and testimony today. So later... when we finish with going through the amendments, and there's several that we need presentations on here, I didn't count how many there are here, but a lot of them, then we'll go to questions. So at that time, there'll be discussion and questions. So Mr. Kerber, do you want to finish up here real quick?
Mr. Chair, I think that's the end of... the amendments, I believe, that last one was the 825, and that's the last one that I'm aware of.
And okay. So do you want or not that one?
Mr. Chair, I think we're just seeing this for the first time, and maybe
not sure.
If we can talk about it, maybe among ourselves here a
okay.
bit.
Maybe somebody who, I thought this was from you, but apparently not. I'll put it in the section from not you.
Okay.
So now we'll start with the amendments from non-agency. So 05, does somebody want to testify on that? Is there anybody? Is there anybody on 05?
Well, Mr. Chair,
I guess not.
Before we go into the amendments, I'd like to clarify some of the stuff that's in the current bill and those amendments so I understand before I decide if I want to support or defend the amendment. I'd kind of like to get clarity on some of the stuff that the testifier actually went over, if I may. I mean, I've written down a number of questions that I'd like clarified in my head before I decide whether I like any.
Well, Representative Howell, I'm going to do what I said, which is to get testimony. We're going to get testimony. Mr. Kerber and staff will be available, I'm sure, right, Mr. Kerber,
yes.
So you can ask staff about that. There's not another way we can get testimony from people other than right now. You can ask. We'll be here probably quite a while today from what I'm hearing. You can ask staff at that time. We'll try and I'm sure Mr. Kerber or his staff will be available, whereas we can't have that for testimony. We can't do testimony that way. So I want to get testimony in first. Okay, so is there anybody on the A5 amendment? No, nobody's claiming that. The A6 amendment, is anybody claiming that? No? Okay. The A13 amendment, anybody have that? A lot of people put in amendments. No one on the A13 amendment? Okay. No one on the, is there anyone on the A14 amendment?
That's the department amendment.
No, he said they don't like it. So it's not a department amendment. Nobody claims the A14 amendment?
A14 is the department's.
No. This is the one that...
Mr. Chair, this is the liability insurance, and
right.
This is what we had already agreed to do this in the Senate. So this is wouldn't be our first choice, but it we're okay with this one.
So you are?
As an alternative, yeah, the A14 versus the later numbered one. This is the one where as an alternative to requiring the insurance, it makes it very clear that the parents will have notice that the insurance is going to expire. So we're okay.
So you're changing the department's position on this one.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair. So which one does it compare to that you did put in initially?
The A14.
20 is the one you don't want.
Mr. Chair, A14 is preferred over the A20.
20.
And what is preferred over the A14?
Right. The language in the current bill.
Current bill.
Yeah.
Okay.
Right.
First choice is that insurance is required.
Okay.
Second choice is that the parents would always be totally informed
but
when
no.
That policy is going to expire.
Let me clarify or try to help you clarify or at least get you to clarify. That would be nicer. You said first choice is to require it. Second choice is A14. Later is A20. But now are you saying... requiring it is no longer your first choice, that the A14 is your first choice? I mean,
Mr. Chair,
the department has to have...
Yeah, the bill as written requires it.
Right, I understand that.
And so that would be our first choice. But we have said that we would be okay with the language that's in the A14.
But you're not moving the
A14. We prefer...
Or not preferring to move it?
Our preference would be to not have that.
Okay. That's what I had originally said, and I thought you said you changed that preference. Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Meyer.
Mr. Chair, would you please go through the numbers of the department's amendments, please, just so that we're clear on that?
I'm sorry. Okay. 7, 8, 9, 10,
11, 12, 15, 16, 17, and 23.
And then 14, is there amendment or not?
No, it's an it's the one they prefer what's in the bill.
Okay.
If we don't go with what's in the bill, then they'll accept 14.
And 14 and 20 are the same, almost the same.
20 they do not want because that is they are opposed to 20.
And Mr. Chair, I believe that A23 is also they have it in A17.
I'm sorry. Wait, what's the purchase then?
A17 is their choice, not A23.
Right. Did I leave out 17? The 823 is a subset of the A17. Oh, yes, you're correct. 23 if we didn't, if not A17.
And Mr. Chair? Thank you. And just to, okay, so on the A14, A20s, the department prefers what's in the bill.
Right.
But if they had to take an amendment, they would take the A14,
right,
but not the A20.
Right.
What specific part don't they like in the 14-20? Do we clarify?
14 requires.
Okay.
Right, no, I'm sorry. The bill requires liability insurance. 14 does not.
Okay.
But it's very specific about notifying parents. And the 20 isn't as specific or doesn't require as much info to parents.
Thank you.
Okay, we're up to 8.
And Mr. Kerber, if you could maybe specify which of these amendments were drafted by the department just to reflect things that happened in the Senate in the interest of transparency.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Mr. Grafton, the amendments that we put forward for drafting were those amendments that represented issues that had already been discussed and the department had a position in the Senate that we were okay with them.
Okay.
And that, I mean, just to further confuse, that does go to that insurance thing, too. I mean, our first preference, of course, is that liability insurance be required. But second, if it's not going to be required, the parental notification.
But Mr. Kerber, you know that around here, what the Senate says usually means we're against it.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'm aware of that.
The worst thing you can say on the House floor is this passed, yeah, this bill passed the Senate unanimously.
Mm-hmm. So, Mr. Chair, there were no new issues that we brought forth with any of the amendments that we put in for drafting. These were all things that had been discussed with provider groups.
And I think a couple of the ones that you just proposed were actually drafted by somebody else, but you're supporting them. So, okay, 18. Does anybody want the A18?
Mr. Chair, that is drafted to a section that is no longer in the bill.
In the
bill, yes.
Okay, that's
this
what I thought.
This deals with Section 8, and we're starting at Section 11 for the discussion.
Right, I knew that, and the department was neutral on it. I just wanted to know somebody. Since it does kind of relate, and I believe it doesn't involve costs.
We're starting at Section 11
for
discussion.
Okay, so then 19. Anybody want 19? Somebody wants 19?
Yep, she's coming up.
We're all muddling through here. My name is Nick Hingham. I have a general testimony that might give some basis to what the reasonings are behind this, or do you want me just to speak just to the amendments?
If it can be quick, the general, that's okay.
Yeah.
And then make sure you discuss the amendment.
Yes. It just might help what I have to say about the amendments.
We couldn't get your name.
I'm sorry. My name is Cindy Cunningham.
I'm a licensed child care provider in Ramsey County for 15 years. I'm a member of the Ramsey County Licensed Provider Association, the State Association, MLFCCA, and I'm a member of the Public Policy Committee for MLFCCA, and over the past few days, the acting chair. If you look at the handouts that I've given you, I believe that they're not in any accurate order possibly, but the front page with my testimony, the second's the pediatrics guide for sudden infant death. The next one is the FCCI county statement. The point I'm really trying to make is there's a large voice of providers who have spent an enormous amount of time, including myself, trying to understand and partner with DHS and with parents and with everyone and trying to figure out what is the solution to this situation. What I will go back down through is that I was able to attend virtually almost all of the meetings with DHS. I've had numerous conversations with Mr. Kerber, most pleasant, and I have appreciated the engagement with DHS. I did receive the DHS licensing data that was used at least in a format that is the basis for the Mortality Review Committee's work. I have gone through almost over half of the actions in each of those cases and spent way too much time trying to figure out what really happened in that from a layperson but a provider's standpoint. Mr. Kerber has said, and you've heard him here today, said that the goal is that if a child dies, that the safe sleep is not the problem, that providers are following the rules. And I suggest that very little of this legislation that's been presented actually accomplishes that. It actually complicates much that could be done simply. My plea is to implement legislation that strengthens the definition of what is expected so that providers can comply and so that DHS can have accurate and consistent oversight. Section 12, the Fritz bill, as it's being pulled into 1233, I actually worked with Representative Franson to get some clarification there about the age of the child that is affected and also about the sheets and the tight-fitting sheets, so working with some definition of that. That is the one aspect of this bill that actually resolves a lot of the problems. It puts in charge who needs to be in charge, which is the physician. This is a medical condition. And it clarifies tight-fitting sheets. It clarifies a lot of the things that we can look at it as providers and know what is expected of us. The simplistic way to do it, and I'm known for visuals, I apologize, but if you look on about the third page, this is safe sleep. This is what we're supposed to do. And there's a point in here where, I don't know what appropriate, I'm extremely tired because of the work, so bear with my wording, but this is as simple as it gets. And as providers, we are much more intelligent and capable of accomplishing this with proper training and proper direction and proper oversight. Providers who cannot do this, I would probably say should not be providing care, because if they want to put babies on their stomachs because that's what they feel like they should be doing, the question is begged, what else are they doing because that's what they want to be doing. In the data, there were cases where if the provider was not providing a safe sleep environment, there were other issues in the licensed home. It was not just isolated just to that situation. So again, I challenge to really look at the Fritz bill that's now in 1233 as the language. The one piece I have is that DHS has elevated itself to the point of being the physician and the AAP, and there are things such as the swaddling that I wholeheartedly disagree with. We have cultures in our communities that is the basis of how they care for their children. We talk about children being shaken or being upset. Swaddling is the one aspect that gives providers a tool to actually comfort children. That being said, the aspect of swaddling that's a problem, they're not mutually opposing each other. Again, if you look at the second to the last page, there's two quotes there from the AAP. The point being that when the AAP created the safe sleep environment, swaddling is not a preventative measure of SIDS. That is the terminology that's in the AAP standards. It does not prevent SIDS. However, the AAP within its own guidelines says swaddling should be done to comfort children. Both of those can happen. You can swaddle and comfort a child, put them in. You're not going to stop SIDS by swaddling them. That's the terminology. So please, I ask you to look very carefully at that. The issue with swaddling is twofold. If a child is wrapped in a blanket and they break out of the blanket, you now have a loose bedding in the crib that can cause a suffocation situation. The second is if wrapped improperly and too tightly, hip dysplasia. Sorry, I'm really dry mouth here. The hip dysplasia is the problem with that. Dr. Karp is within the AAP website. He's recommended from that. There is a way to blanket swaddle a child. What we propose within MLFCCA is one of the amendments about the swaddle sacks, and yes, I did bring it with if you're not familiar with them, if you want to see it. But the reality is that the recommendation is that you swaddle the upper torso. There are products on the market that do that, that leave the bottom half of the child loose so you do not have the hip dysplasia aspect of it. The top part is tight. If the child's arms come out, those wings or whatever system that is in that particular product stay fastened. They do not become loose. So the child's arms might come out, but there is no loose bedding left with the child. So I think we're doing a great disservice both for providers for not giving them a very practical tool to be able to handle that. The other piece in that is if a provider or a parent really wants to do a blanket swaddle, yes, they can go and get a physician's directive and be trained and know how to do a blanket swaddle so that is appropriately done and taken responsibility under the physician's care. But again, we need to be able to have tools to comfort children so we're not shaking them, so we're not frustrated, so that we have a tool. It's when the child rolls over, but it's very explicit on the products and in the training that once the child rolls over, you cannot swaddle. So the terminology or the process of having a documentation whereby the child's documented that they roll over. One of the amendments talks about 6 months. I think most babies, I've got them right now, 3 months, you're starting to do that. So we need to be on a constant guard with that, not a dated guard with it. And it is an important criteria with it.
Ms. Cunningham, I know what I was, everything I read was more like 4 to 6 weeks and then not go much after that. Because they start to roll over.
The AAP does talk about it is into that 2-4 months, but it is when the child demonstrates rolling over.
Just a question for clarification. I know there's blanket swaddling, but did the department in their recommended amendments say that there couldn't be any swaddling? I'm trying to...
That's fine. My understanding...
I thought the bill had that, but I thought they recommend... Am I wrong about... Maybe, Mr. Kerber, you could... Or one of
the amendments, to my understanding, the way they were presented, were confused about when it talked about the swaddling with the wings, that was actually MLFCCA's amendment that was put in. My understanding from DHS is there can be no swaddling of any fashion, including any system that would potentially safely swaddle a child. We cannot do that.
Okay, can I just interrupt to clarify?
That's fine.
Mr. Chair, I believe that what we had talked about is the A-10 amendment. And the A-10 amendment was one of those that the department requested to be drafted.
Right.
And it reflects a position that the department had received feedback on that this would be reasonably acceptable to the Minnesota SID Center.
So
this was
you are recommending 10, and doesn't that... Ms. Cunningham, doesn't that allow swaddling?
Can I look at 10? Yeah. I'm sorry. I really don't come here.
Mr. Chair, are we off the A-19 amendment now? That's what we started on.
That's the idea. I apologize.
That's okay. I'm trying to
break Representative Kreisha. The testimony has kind of taken us to this, and I'm trying to allow
okay. So I'm clear.
And I just wanted to do the basis by which I'm speaking because I've invested a lot in
And I just wanted to clarify this part of the testimony.
My understanding that I verbally have heard from DHS is that placing a swaddled infant down to sleep in a licensed setting is not recommended for any infant of any age and is prohibited for any infant who has begun to roll over independently. What has verbally been told us in meetings and such is that it will be disallowed. It was said on the Senate floor Monday night, sorry if I'm bringing up the Senate, that the, I got that, it's right now there's nothing in writing whether we can or we can't, but licensors are penalizing, charging fines to providers who are even using these safe sleep sacks and processes with it.
But are you against having the parent consent?
What I am, this is where the amendments get a little mixed up for me. I am against a I am against prohibiting that we cannot swaddle. If what I'm against is the parents recommending this or saying that we can swaddle, because I strongly believe in the 220 Fritz bill, if we can refer to it that way, is the physician should be making that directive. It should not be. We're going to be going right back to a parent directive on swaddling. Good.
So you would not. You would. I'm just trying to clarify.
That's okay. I know. That's fine.
It's the 10 says it's not recommended, which really isn't anything special. But then it's prohibited once they roll over, which seems to be what you're saying. They shouldn't do swaddling after the infant is rolled over. But then it allows written consent of the parent. Are you against allowing it with written consent of the parent?
I'm against the parent making the directive, yes. I am for the physician. The second aspect of the parent.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's okay. They're both.
Read A and D.
Well, and I'm not sure I know any of this at this. The amendment part of it.
I'm sorry.
I'm very lost. If there is a need.
So if it's the parent and the doctor both, then it's okay with you, or?
Yeah, but ultimately, I think the wording is making it more confusing than less confusing. If you the amendments that we're presenting are as if you give providers and parents a process to be able to appropriately and safely swaddle. And if they want to use a blanket swaddle system, then they should be getting a physician's directive to do that.
Okay, Representative Lane said that's what this says, and I think that's pretty much
okay.
If you...
I would suggest that what we have directly heard from DHS and from licensors, if you read the wording of the not recommended and whatever, we're going to have every single parent having to go get a doctor's order just so that your child can be comforted and cared for it. And I think that's a line that's at that point when we have a very simplified tool that can be used for providers. So our stance would be give providers and parents the tool by where we can comfort and care for a child in an appropriate, safe manner. And if they want to go outside of that part and do a blanket swaddle, then the physician's directive would take it. And the wording does not need to be in this. That's already taken care of.
Just, again, clarification, Mr. Kerber, did you say this came from Senate language?
Mr. Chair, yes.
Without any connotation.
And language that I have referred, that I've been in contact with the Minnesota SID Center.
I think
the distinction Ms. Cunningham is making here is that where in the department's language here in the A-10, it's saying that if an infant, it's not recommended, the Minnesota SID Center doesn't recommend it, the American Academy of Pediatrics doesn't recommend it for child care providers, but if it's going to be provided, then it should be with the consent of the parent and the physician. I think Ms. Cunningham is saying that if that can be sliced one more time, and that if the provider is going to be using a sleep sack as described in the A25 amendment, then that use of swaddling should not require a physician's approval, only a parent approval.
Ms. Cunningham, is that what you're saying?
I would say that it doesn't need a parent approval written, no. I would challenge that it is recommended by the AAP to use swaddling. It is not recommended to use it to prevent SIDS. That's the distinction that's made. AAP says swaddle children to comfort them. If you go to their website, it's very clear. Swaddle children to comfort them. Put them down to sleep. Swaddle to comfort them. But if you want to prevent SIDS, swaddling isn't the one thing that you should be doing. I mean, if you want to say, I'm going to prevent SIDS, so therefore I'm going to swaddle so then my child won't die of SIDS, that's not a proven method. So we're talking, I don't know how to clarify it. Do you understand?
Yeah.
Mr. Chair.
Okay.
Can you just help me in?
We're right now just trying to clarify
right.
things
yeah.
as to where.
That's what. So can you walk me through a scenario? Daycare mm-hmm. provider, mom comes in. Does the daycare provider want to have the choice to swallow? You have that conversation. Here's my question. Something unfortunate happens. What protections kick in for the parent and for the daycare provider? That's what I think this amendment is getting to. Is
there's a reasonable conversation, and then there's a situation that happens, and what happens after that? What would you like to see happen?
If there will be blanket swaddling, there needs to be a physician's directive, because what happens in blanket swaddling, the child breaks out of the blanket, and you have a loose blanket in the bed. That's the hazard with blanket swaddling. The system, the sleep sack systems, if you look back to the picture, it talks about a one-piece sleeper. The sleep sack systems are a one-piece sleeper. They fit under the AAP guidelines. Unfortunately, they have, in this environment, they have a very negative moniker that if they, you know, if you somehow take a product that's designed, tested, and proven by the consumer product safety, you know, they're the ones that are in charge about whether these work or not. If you have something that actually helps the child sleep, some reason in this context, that's not okay. So I would like personally to see, and MLFCCA has said, we would like the sleep sacks, single sleep sack systems to be in language, and that the ones with the swaddling ability of the upper torso that's built into the swaddle, so it's manufactured to be used that way, we're not adding something in, that those systems be okay. When you ask me about how a parent comes in, that's almost on a daily conversation. How's the baby doing? Are they fussy? Are they not fussy? You know, sometimes I'll put, as a child gets slightly older, I'll put them down and they start not wanting to be swaddled. But then there's times where they're really cranky and really fussy, and swaddling is exactly what they need. So the drawing is on the need of the child, and yes, there's constant conversation with the parents on what they're doing and how they're doing. That's the practical part. Did that help?
My follow-up.
Representation.
Here's my only, we're about to write public policy.
I understand.
How does public policy get in the way of what you're doing? I mean, I'm going to this going, how is this helping? It's a whole bunch of public policy that it seems like we can't even get down to the nuts and bolts of taking care of the infant and that reasonable conversation. That's my concern. I mean, how do you write a public policy that's clear for you to have a conversation with your parents? What is it? What is that policy?
Mr. Kerber and Ms. Cunningham, can you figure out exactly what the difference is between the two of you and say it in terms we can understand?
Members, I think the difference is that the A25 amendment goes into some specificity about a product that can be used for swaddling. The A10 amendment did not. The A10 amendment was merely the procedure in that if a family child care provider is going to use swaddling, they should have the permission of the parent and the physician.
And just one second. I believe you agree with that. Am I correct?
No, to some extent. If I can speak for her,
probably not. But go ahead.
I think where we differ here, and not necessarily that we're in difference, but I think Ms. Cunningham is saying that a physician's directive is not a bad idea, but it should be limited to those situations when swaddling is done with a blanket.
If the one piece sleepers are allowed with the process of a swaddle option, which is available, a physician's order should not be needed for that. If you're swaddling with a blanket, which is what people go to, I've had children for 21 years, is my oldest. These weren't available when he was young. I would have not a clue what we were talking about if I wasn't currently taking care of a 3-month-old. There are products that are developed that you can use that accomplishing swaddling without it being a bad thing. If we give everyone those tools, one, we can deal with many cultures without it saying, oh, no, we can't swaddle. I think that's a really bad message to be stating. So with this, if they wanted to have swaddling, traditional swaddling with a blanket, it just goes right under the Fritz Bill physician's order. It's a modification of the sleep environment. It does not need to be written here.
So a traditional blanket swaddle falls within the Fritz
it would
language,
go
and you think, so it would require a physician?
Correct.
What you think is that
And that would be also prohibited once they've rolled over.
Correct, yes. That's actually where children die, is if they roll over while they're swallowed.
Yes. What the literature was very important on. So the one difference is, does everybody understand?
Oh, yeah.
I'm sure Representative Franson does, but not all of us are working with swaddling every day.
I brought it if you want to see it. Sorry.
She's holding it up back there. Okay, I think we are, Mr. Kerber?
Mr. Chair, I might just clarify. I was reminded of something, that use of a blanket for swaddling is not something that the department supports. I mean, even with the swaddling, I mean, we haven't really specified that kind of thing, but the infant should not have a blanket in the crib. If you swaddle an infant with a blanket, there's always a risk that infant that the blanket will become loose, and then it's an asphyxiation risk. And so,
but you're saying up until the rollover, the A10 would allow it with the physician and parent approval.
Mr. Chair, and we weren't intending to get that specific here, figuring that the parent and the physician and the provider would figure out the best, safest way to deal with this without getting into the products. But so if we're into the product discussion, the product that Ms. Cunningham is talking about is much better than a loose blanket being snugly secured around the infant.
Where are we at?
Okay.
Part of our problem with the...
I'm just trying to state a clarification that I can understand. So the difference is that you are saying that it should be okay without a doctor's permission in a certain type.
Correct.
But then somebody's going to have to define that type.
We do have it defined in A25. Is that the right one? Sorry.
This one piece.
I'm really not a legislator.
Which allows with.
A25.
Yeah. Okay, so that A25 is yours then?
Yes, it is.
Oh, okay. Okay.
We will get back to 19, right?
We started on 19. But I guess we might as well, since we're really wrapped up in...
if I may speak to that, it is a really hot piece because of how it's been interpreted in conjunction with the SIDS, which is the issue we're talking about.
Right, exactly. And we're talking about SIDS. Although we're not formal today, so why don't you... You've started on 19, wrapped it into 25 now. Why don't you explain that, since we're already talking about that?
Explain 25?
Yeah.
Okay, sorry.
Maybe that'll clarify where you want to go against where they want to go.
I'm going to take a break.
Do us, Mr. Chair.
Oh, I'm sorry. I don't know any formality. I'm sorry.
Mr. Chair, I'm Katie Chase, Executive Director of Minnesota Licensed Family Child Care Association, and I think Cindy is asking if I may speak to this and maybe help clarify the issue here. The reason we put forth Amendment 25 was because we felt that there did need to be better clarification than the other amendment, the department's amendment, because we do not support the loose blanket swaddling, but we do support having providers have the tools that they need to calm infants. The 1 out of 12 reasons why providers are placing infants in an unsafe sleep position is for calming. So swaddling is one of the ways that the AAP does recommend for calming. To make it simple and more clear, we would like A25 passed so that it is simply allowed to use approved swaddling sacks with the wings, as Cindy was explaining to you, so that they were giving the provider the tool to help children calm. We do not want the language allowing parents to tell a provider they can swaddle with a loose blanket, because
even with the doctor's
supplement?
Well, I'm not a doctor. I suppose I wouldn't overrule a doctor, but the way the wording is written, it's or, I believe.
No, it's, I read it wrong. It's
yeah, so we're allowing, we're going to be back in the same place that we were with the, parent allowing providers to.
No, this is and.
It's an and.
Okay.
It's an and. So it's with doctors.
Well, again, it would just be simpler to adopt A25 in our opinion so that we're not even going there with the loose blanket, but we are allowing the approved sleep sack.
Okay.
That's what we're advocating for.
So the department is saying it's okay up till they roll over to do it with a blanket swaddle with.
No, sorry, you're not.
There's, well, I mean, I don't want to speak for the department, but I'm thinking that with a parent and a physician recommendation,
right.
Yes, and we don't want that. We want A25.
So what I was saying was correct. They want to allow it up until they've rolled over.
Well, Mr. Chair.
With the approval of the parent and a doctor.
The department is saying they don't recommend it.
Right.
Only if they're...
Exactly.
Right.
Right. But allow is different from recommend. Okay. So we've got that. I think I understand the difference. The department, on the other hand, does... Have you decided on where you are on 25 yet? By the way, for those that don't know this... Swaddling thing was 2 hours in the Senate.
And you said you didn't even want to take up, you know, that long, so.
I know, exactly. So somehow we're going to have to get swaddling settled.
Mr. Chair, I think, you know, the department's preference here would be to blend both the A10 and the A25 together.
That's what I was looking at. Is there some way the two of you can maybe work together to...
If I think that getting specific on the product to be used isn't where we were going, but that does make sense just for the sake of clarity. And using those products is certainly better than a blanket. And so we wouldn't want a blanket in the crib, even though we weren't kind of getting to that level of detail. So that specificity in the A25 is good.
Just let me... clarify. So you don't want blanket swaddling then?
Mr. Chair, we don't want blanket swaddling. We don't want blankets in the crib. So we don't want, we don't want blanket swaddling. Yes.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Lane.
Since we're not moving any amendments today, I'm wondering if, because 25 does have some additional pieces, delete and change other language, is it possible to just take, or tomorrow, the department could take 10 and change it from blanket swaddling to this particular kind of swaddling and make that change.
That's what I'm basically looking at, and I think they've agreed that it looks to me like you can agree on this, it seems to be.
Physician's order.
The physician's order to do a blanket swaddle, anything other than the sacks, yes. I am very concerned.
What did you just...
Yes, physician's order with blanket.
Then it's okay?
Then it's okay.
Okay.
But otherwise, we want the wording for the sleep systems to be there.
Okay, so you want basically A10, but you want sleep sack without physician order.
Correct.
Is that it? Is that my understanding?
Yes.
Correct? Okay. Then we do have Representative Francis.
Mr. Muller, or Chair Mullery, I just want to make a statement, and this isn't a slam against you, Mr. Kerber, at all, so don't take it that way, but as I'm listening here, I'm like getting kind of frustrating, saying the department wants this, the department wants that, the department doesn't like this, the department doesn't like that, where we've got providers up here who know their job, and they're just, it seems like we're just kind of brushing them off. And
I don't think we're brushing them off. We've had them up here. And
I mean, I'm swaddling this.
We're taking, basically, seem to be taking their position on this. So consider that we're certainly not brushing them off. And that's why I insisted that we weren't going to get to discuss it ourselves until we hear from the providers. So.
Thank you.
That's what I'm looking at, is input from the providers on any disagreements with the agency. And so it looks to me like we've reached an agreement here.
or Mr. Kerber?
Mr. Chair, our position had been, with the amendment, is that there be a physician sign-off on swaddling.
Oh, that's the one difference.
Yeah. And the refining of that position by Ms. Cunningham is that the sign-off on the physician would only be for those situations involving a blanket. And even though we as the department hadn't gotten to that level of specificity about is it a blanket or is it the sleep sack, we don't want blankets in the crib. So, you know, following that along, you'd say we don't want swaddling with a blanket either. But we did and do want that physician approval.
The only difference then is physician approval, and you don't want physician approval on the sleep sack.
On the sleep sacks, correct.
That's approved by. Okay, now at least we now know where all this, the two points of view on this whole issue.
Yes,
I think. Okay, can we go to?
But just a clarification on why, okay. Somewhat why this is a problem, because the beginning part of this. The A10 says it's not recommended. And we have had people from other cultures and people who really rely on this. To make such a statement, I would just say, is disingenuous to recognize people's different cultures and abilities and things that are appropriately and accurately done. In other cultural communities, swaddling is the standard. And for this to be stated, it's wrong, because that's ultimately what the wording is. Yeah. Swaddling is wrong. And that I don't know what the fix is on that. I'll say that. But
Ms. Chase.
Yes, Mr. Chair, committee members, perhaps it would help when we work with Jerry to combine these two amendments that we add wording that it's not proven to lower risk of SIDS. I think maybe that's what the department was trying to get at. But to say that it overall is not recommended is not a true statement.
Get into deciding scientific things here in the next day, which you're asking us to do. We're not going to do that. We're going to have to decide what the law becomes, but we're not going to decide scientific decisions. So can we go back to, you're going to work that out, and you can give us exactly why you differ on anything you differ on. It sounds like we're going to get something back where it's pretty agreeable and very specific why there's any difference. Okay, can we go to, we started on 19. So we spent 35 minutes on swaddling. 19. This is, I believe, your...
MLFCCA is correct, okay. The state associations.
Go ahead and discuss this one.
Okay. What if I take this one? This one comes... the TIS is temporary immediate suspension if there is an unsafe sleep environment. In other words, if the picture is not followed. The concern is twofold. One of the amendments that was here that wasn't moved forward but is in the Senate is a conditional license process, which we have a stance against as a state association. The concern is that we have providers when there has been a blanket in a crib and there's not even an infant in the house that have been getting $200 fines. They would be under this kind of jurisdiction because the clarity is not there about what means imminent harm. So what we're asking for this is that it be made very clear with licensing that we're not talking about a crib without an infant in it. We're talking about a child with a loose blanket, with a pillow, with truly an unsafe sleep environment in an unsafe, hazardous situation. But again, we do have documentation of providers that have gotten fines for a blanket in a crib when there was not even an infant in the house. That's what we're trying to prevent by this language.
Okay, Ms. Chase.
Mr. Chair, committee members, I think if you compare Amendment 05 to Amendment 19, that will help with this issue.
What we're looking at, MLFCCA wants to lower infant deaths in family child care. We have seen the raw data, and most of the providers who had deaths had multiple violations and probably should have been closed down already. They already were not following rules that are in place. So what we're trying to get at here is we don't feel it's okay, actually, to pass off a truly serious, unsafe sleep situation if a provider just says, okay, well, I'll never take care of infants again. I mean, that provider probably should not be in business anyway and is making it look really, really bad for the 10,000-plus providers that are giving excellent care. So what we tried to get at with Amendment A19 in response to Amendment 05 was what Cindy was talking about, which is true. We do have to clarify that this was truly an unsafe sleep situation. And if a truly unsafe sleep, they should be cited.
Okay, now nobody offered 05, so that won't be in consideration. But does this 19 need to be on if we're just looking at the bill and yes. amendments we're talking about?
Mr. Chair, committee members, yes, we would like you to pass Amendment 19. Thank you.
And Mr. Kerber, can you discuss that?
Mr. Chair and members, this section of the law doesn't deal with the fines that were discussed. So that's a different issue. But what this does is it establishes yet another standard. And the temporary immediate suspension language under subdivision 2A, paragraph A, it's going to be in here. Line 19 already establishes what the reasonable cause means, that there exists specific articulable facts or circumstances which provide the commissioner with a reasonable suspicion that there is an imminent risk of harm to health, safety, and rights of persons served by the program. That's a definition that gets a lot of attention in our appeal cases. And in fact, it was amended by the legislature last year, the year before, in response to a court of appeals case. So on line 25, where we're introducing a different concept about immediate danger, the first question will be, well, how does immediate danger relate to the imminent risk of harm standard that's already in the law? Is it something different? Is it the same? And so we prefer that line not be in here at all. We already are charged with that demonstrating that there's a reasonable suspicion that there was imminent risk of harm. And so this is kind of redundant but different, and so it's confusing. So we would prefer not to have that language at all.
In other words, the one has been interpreted by a court. We know what it means. And this would be, courts would probably interpret this as meaning something different than what does it mean.
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Mr. Chair and committee members, the reasoning for the wording, is DHS does already have the authority to do this. It is not a new piece. To put it in as a new piece in the environment that we are living in with as providers, instead of doing a $200 fine, the vast majority of providers are very concerned that licensors out in the state will just go straight to TIS. And so by clarifying for DHS licensing that we're not talking about a blanket in a crib without a baby in the house is what the definition is. We live out where our world is, licensors interpreting this, again, they already have the authority if it's an imminent harm. We don't need to put it in there if that's the case. Then.
1 second, Ms. Cunningham. I thought the licensor the licensor is the agency.
Correct.
The county people around there are monitors, but they can't do anything. Is that correct, Mr. Kerber?
Mr. Chair, that's the perfect distinction. the family child care licensing staff at the counties, as I was describing, the counties have certain authority and responsibility assigned to them under the law, yet much of it remains with the state. So we issue licenses, and we only have the authority to issue licensing sanctions. So a county licensor would be authorized to issue a correction order to a provider. But if there's a suggestion that this is something that's a more serious violation that would warrant a conditional license or a fine or a suspension or a revocation or a temporary immediate suspension, those are all the tools that we have. All of those are issued by the state upon the recommendation of the county. It's through that recommendation process and our review, there's a provision in the regulations that charges us with making sure that there's a consistent interpretation and enforcement throughout the state. And so we wouldn't be issuing a temporary immediate suspension for a blanket being in a crib when there's not even an infant in the house, because we would not be able to demonstrate imminent risk to anybody presented by that blanket in the crib. And one of the things that we will be seeking clarification on, too, is that even if there's not an infant in the house and there's a blanket in the crib, they shouldn't be getting a fine for that. I mean, that would, again, be our office that would issue a fine if there's not an infant in that crib. I mean, we're going to have to be sorting through some of these issues as we go forward, and it's kind of one of the commitments that we've made. If the bill is fully funded, that we would have resources in place to kind of resolve these issues statewide.
Representative Franson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I would hope so, because I know licensors out there that would see a blanket in the crib, even if there was no infant in the house, and write the provider up just because that blanket was in there. And this is where they take a statute and they interpret it to their own reason, and then the provider is stuck with a fine when there's no even... Or perhaps you have your own infant who at night gets a blanket, thank goodness, your own blanket, you know, at night when there's no child care providers around. But what I'm saying is this is just another slippery slope for those licensors to just...
Representative, I don't think it's a slippery slope. I think that the agency actually probably should do more training of licensors, and the county, whatever you call it,
licensors.
Licensors, but control the any fines or anything, or whatever somebody can appeal to the agency.
Mr.
So it sounds, I'm concerned about your language opening up too much, mm-hmm. and I'd like to see if there's a way that you can get together a little better on that somehow. I don't like your language. I'm afraid the courts isn't going to know where this all goes then. But I understand what you're talking about, and maybe you can come up with something, hopefully, to deal with that. What is your, is 20 the next one?
Yes.
So I believe your number 20 is also yours, is that correct? Or is anybody, does
yeah,
anybody want 20?
Yeah, that's one of ours.
This one.
Oh. You okay?
This is the one that's similar to 814.
Oh, but this is the one the department wouldn't accept. They'll accept 14. Is that a? Can you come? The department wants the bill. You want 20. Can you both agree on 14?
Probably not. No. distinction for us is, I don't have 14 in front of me, I apologize. There's way too many trees going down here. in the method of which I do things, I called our, and ended up talking to the CEO of one of the largest child care insurance companies in the state of Minnesota, and said, explain to me what insurance is like from your end.
And part of it, in talking through it with him to understand the industry, is when there really is not an expiration date, there's a renewal date. It's like your car insurance. It just keeps on going. And you just pay. If you don't pay, it ends. In ours also, on line 1.13, the license holder must notify all parents and guardians in writing immediately of any change in insurance status. That takes care of if I lapse, if it does not continue, but it will keep out of the thing where we have to always be producing and turning over paperwork, that level of kind of unnecessary paperwork turnover. The other piece is that, I forgot. Oh, that if the, instead of the posting, which obviously this goes, is already pulled off in somewhat, but the example was given to me, if you have a roofer come out and you want to know about their insurance, they produce a certificate. So upon demand, both from the parents or under our inspections from our licensors, we should be able to produce that certificate to prove that on that moment, on that day, we do have insurance. And by doing that, that was our method by which to say to the department, we take this seriously.
Actually, we do, under a lot of the laws, have posting at the employer site. So I'm not sure that that's very onerous.
Well, the distinction, I guess, was made that not all do. And one of the pieces is this: these are our homes. We're not standalone businesses. And there's providers have feel that there's kind of a crossover in there if we're going to post a liability insurance part of it, but to be able to produce upon demand the certificate of liability.
Could be, though, that some parents would feel uncomfortable when they know, let's say, going to my next door neighbor, I might feel uncomfortable asking them that. Maybe that, I don't know what, that's just a thought as to what the department's thinking. So I think I understand the distinction where the two are. What I'm going to do at the end is ask the two groups to meet and tell me where you can agree on things, and then very specific as to each point that's different on something, and then two sentences as to why your point is right and why the other one is right, or something like that. Ms. Chase, was it?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. I just wanted to make one point of clarification here. A20 doesn't require parents to have to ask you if you have insurance. It requires providers to notify parents of any change in their insurance
right.
status, so they wouldn't have that issue to have to ask for it.
Mr. Kerber?
Mr. Chair, I just might add that what's required in the A20 amendment is what's currently required in the licensing rule for child care providers.
Oh.
I think is not really any difference, and that's what we were finding wasn't working. And so we saw that there need to be some change, either initially everybody's required to have insurance, or secondarily that the difference is that the parents are receiving a notice that says when that policy is going to expire. So they can wait to see, they can monitor something themselves if it's important to them. Is my provider going to renew or let it lapse? So that they're just on notice, they can put it on their calendar if they want, or if it's not important to them, they don't have to. But then the provider's required to circle back again at that time and let them know what they did about it.
So
that's the difference.
The department is saying A20 is what's in rule now, and it's not working, so you need a little more.
Mr. Chair, that's our position, yes.
Okay. 21 is yours also, then?
Mr. Chair, committee members, this is a very important one for us because MLFCCA strongly believes that the real way we're going to help fix this situation is to have increased oversight of the rules, the great safe sleep rules we already have on the books, and much better training and availability about these issues, and safe sleep issues in particular. So we have rampant inconsistencies across the state in licensors and what they interpret and what they allow for training. Our current SIDS training is outdated. It shows a blanket in it. We need a lot of help in this area. So this is an attempt to open up by requiring licensors across the state to accept any training that's approved by Minnesota Center for Professional Development, including online training such as Eager to Learn or what we call relationship-based professional development or mentoring like the MLCCA mentoring.
That you're talking about lines 1-5 through 1-10.
That's correct.
A couple of other amendments that they want. So you seem to be wanting the same as that with regard to 1-5 through 1-10.
That's correct.
But the other part is you want only 8 hours instead of 16, is that it?
I'm going to speak to that.
It seems like 1-5 through 1-10 you agree with, everybody's in agreement on.
MLFCCA historically has always wanted to have increased training, but the issue is having availability and access statewide to it. Our public policy committee did vote very quickly. These things have to change very quickly and change this idea to 8, but the MLFCCA Board of Directors has not voted on this issue. So adequate understanding that DHS has proven to the commissioner that this training, the increased training, is affordable and accessible statewide. The MLFCCA Board of Directors has not opposed the increase to 16, but we do have a strong group of providers, of course, that would not like to see it doubled in 1 year.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just curious, are there any costs associated with this to the counties? Any fiscal notes we should be aware of for any of the increased training?
Mr. Kerber.
Mr. Chair, what the cost for the department had identified with this increased training is that the department intended to subsidize the training. And so I don't remember the total amount, but that was a significant part of the bill language itself. It was in the governor's initial proposal that did not end up in Representative Huntley's proposed budget bill. So it was that for the counties themselves, probably it isn't an increase in cost for them. I mean, this is really kind of directing what they will accept as far as the training. The training would not be provided necessarily by county employees. The training would be provided by other groups as specified here. So probably not an increased cost for them.
Okay, thank you. Then
Mr. Chair. Yes, Mr. Chair, members. It's not an increased cost for the counties. It certainly would be an increased cost for the providers.
Thank you. Okay, 22 then. We're going to go a little bit over them. That somebody's, don't know who 22 is. Okay. And 24. Does anybody know who that is?
That's yours.
That's yours?
Okay,
go ahead.
Sorry. what are we talking about? Hold out. I believe, if I'm right, this
what
is
it does
regarding
is
the SIDS
it
training.
Changes the SIDS training
okay.
from a year to 2 years.
Correct. Our position on this is that if the SIDS training is done properly, to meet the guidelines of AAP with that picture that I show of the safe sleep environment, every 2 years every year is quite significant. It's not a hard standard to try to reach to be able to put children in that sleep. I don't know what I did with my note, but when I was listening, the SIDS Shaken Baby is a yearly video. Excuse me, the Shaken Baby is a half-hour yearly video training. The SIDS is a two-hour, I believe, not a half-hour. So we are asking providers to sit through training that is really not going to add value or really change behavior to what they're doing. So we felt that every year was quite a leap that would not necessarily benefit and would also take up training hours of providers to be able to do other things like other types of supervision areas.
So you're saying that it would be better to have the training time on something other than SIT? Is that what you're saying?
I'm saying that training every 2 years from providers would be adequate to be able to get us to change behaviors of SIDs, and to do it every year is redundant, and that we would be able to then also be able to take other trainings that would also help us be able to care carefully and safely for children.
I think that's what I said.
I know.
Just much shorter.
I'm just really tired.
Ms. Chase.
Mr. Chair and committee members, that's an overall concern that we hear of having so many specific content-specific trainings that are the same trainings required year after year. If you have a provider, most of our providers go well over what's required. But if they're only going to do what's required, and then you have so much of content-specific training that you have to do every year, when do you actually improve? When do you actually get above and beyond that professional development piece? So you are correct.
That's one thing I'm really into, is having our, at least Minnesota, child care workers trained. We have one of the top researcher institutions in the country on brain development for children here at the university. And so that's one of my passions, is to get that spread statewide. But Mr. Kerber, what do you...
Mr. Chair and members, this is kind of a serious issue, I think. And it relates to the fact that we have been seeing as many as 11 deaths a year in family child care. What happened, though, after the publicity about this issue and, you know, multiple newspaper articles, and we had lots of conversations, and we sent out a notice to all the providers, is that it went from the last death we had was in July of 2012 until we had one more in January. But we've only, since last July, we have had one. Yet we had been at a rate of almost, you know, just short of one a month. And so we don't know why there has been a decrease, except that probably it's reasonable to think that with all of the increased attention and all the focus on this, that people must be doing some things differently. And so that seems to be instructive for, well, how do we maintain this? And it seems like one of the ways to maintain it is to keep the conversation going about how important this is. Of all of the training and all the changes that we're making here, it seems that none is more specifically related to the issue itself of how do you put an infant down in a crib safely than this SIDS training. And you know, we're not really talking about SIDS so much. SIDS, you know, is that medical diagnosis after the fact, after everything else has been ruled out. But, you know, in 75% of the cases, there were unsafe sleep arrangements when the child died. And so it seems...
Question, does SIDS include suffocation? Or?
Well, it wouldn't. Then that would be if a child was asphyxiated on a blanket or a pillow or a stuffed animal or face down on the mattress on a soft blanket, none of those would technically be SIDS. And so it seems to us that of all of the things we're requiring, this is probably one that hones in on that particular issue more than anything else, and to keep that conversation, to keep that awareness going. Now, certainly there may not be something new every year in this training, but most of us take annual training that has some of the same topics over and over again. And so to keep the focus up, you know, we think it's pretty important. Right now it's every 5 years, which is way too far out there. You know, annually, you know, the law requires it has to be at least a half an hour. Ms. Cunningham is saying it's 2 hours long when you receive it. But at least, you know, this is one that we're really pretty serious about as being an annual training.
One quarter. Okay.
Yeah.
Ms. Chase, you're in between the two of them. He's saying a half hour, she's saying 2 hours. Are you going to say it's one and a quarter? go ahead.
Mr. Chair, committee members, I wasn't going to argue that point. I mean, the law, if it says half an hour, the problem is I think some of the training that's being offered just happens to be longer. You can't get a
shorter version. But what I did want to address is, I agree with Mr. Kerber, I'm glad he brought up that there's only been one death now since July of 2012, and that's because of what we've, MLFCCA has always advocated for. What we need is to reignite this public awareness campaign of Safe Sleep and Back to Sleep. That has made a huge difference. The providers know what safe sleep is. It's already in the law. They've been trained on it over and over again. The people who are choosing to place them in an unsafe sleep situation need to have better oversight. That's what will really help this issue. And then having an overall public policy campaign on reigniting that back to sleep that we saw in the 90s when it did dramatically lower and now it's going up again. This is what is most important. To do a training every year that's the same may take away from other professional development, and the people who aren't going to follow the rules are still not going to follow the rules.
Mr. Kerber.
I respect all their positions, certainly. One of the things that we're looking at here is, you know, the likelihood of an infant dying on any given single time that the infant is put down is really low. You know, if there's, say that there's, just for the math, say there's 10,000 family child care providers, there's 11. But say if each has two infants and they put them down twice a day, you know, that's four times a day per home that there's a chance that an infant would die. If you multiply that by 10,000, you're getting up into the millions of times over a 10.5 year period that we're talking about here. And even that we had 83 deaths, you know, against those millions of times that infants were put down, shows that it's an event that's not likely to occur. There's been some very interesting research about what do you do in these cases where and we've had some conversations with St. Cloud State University and their behavioral analysis department, and they're looking at doing some research in this area because it falls within this category of rule governed behavior where the likelihood of an adverse consequence is very, very low. But when it occurs, it's terrible. And so how do you get people to self-monitor their behavior differently, knowing that it's really unlikely that things are going to go badly for me here? One of the things that gets talked about is to help people understand, you know, that there is a likelihood, and this is what this is how it would affect your life. I mean, it's kind of the opposite of winning the Powerball. You see commercials and you see ads about how this is how wonderful my life would be if this very unlikely event would occur. This is the flip side. This is how bad my life would be if something like this happened. And so it's similar to Mothers Against Drunk Driving campaign, where people who have had perhaps one DWI actually have an encounter with people who have been driving and have maybe killed somebody. And they get to see, get an explanation of how that person's life has been impacted. And then also have some contact with family, so they get to see how that impacted those other families. We don't want to rely only on the government having more oversight to make sure people are compliant. We want to somehow instill in them a notion that I really do need to do this, even though it's really unlikely that the infant is going to die at this time. I need to do this for other reasons.
I just want to, I was informed some other people wanted to testify. I was, okay, sorry. We've had quite a bit of time there. How many others want to testify? Melinda, are you on this issue?
No, Mr. Chair.
You're not on, I mean, on any child care safety?
No.
Oh, okay. We're nothing outside of sections 11 through 18 is going to be going anywhere. So how many are on sections 11 through 18? One, two? Okay, why don't the two of you come up? Do you want to, the ones that are on 11 through 18, which is child care safety, the rest of it is not going to be going anywhere, so we're not going to hear it. I talked to the chair this morning. If you're on 19 through the end,
maybe you didn't hear me earlier. 19 through the end is wrapped with huge costs, and so they're not going to look at it going on, so we don't have time to hear anything on the other parts of the bill.
Mr. Chair, sorry to speak of that. Will it be amended off the bill then as the committee moves forward, just as a procedural question? Still technically in the bill as it sits?
Probably tomorrow, and I think what's going to happen is what we pass tomorrow is going to probably have a chance of being added to the omnibus bill.
Can I make a quick comment on the training, or would you?
Why don't we let the, we don't have much time, and so I was not aware, I'm sorry, state your name and go ahead, and if there was one other hand up, if that person would come up, so you're also ready. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
Mr. Chair, my comments are very brief. I'm Cindy Bartell. I'm an attorney from Minneapolis, Minnesota, and I represent families of children who have died in licensed daycares, and I came down here to present statements of two parents. But I just want to let all of you committee members know that we're very happy with many of the daycare licensing reforms that the Department of Human Services has worked so hard to bring to the legislature this session. And just to speak to the points that we've been talking about here today, on the issue of increased SIDS training, the parents are very much in favor of that, as you can imagine. I would just ask you as legislators to put yourself in the shoes of the parents, because many of you are parents, and think about what kind of laws you would want to have in place to protect your babies in licensed daycares. And so to the issue of whether you should have SIDS training once every 5 years or once every year or once every 2 years, I think from the babies' and the parents' perspectives, the answer is obvious. More frequent training, reinforcement of those SIDS requirements is a good thing for the safety of babies. As an attorney, I'm also sensitive to how important it is to have insurance, and we support the Department of Human Services' position that insurance for daycare, licensed daycare providers should be required. It's a good thing for everybody. It protects the provider as much as it protects the victims of perhaps things that happen in daycares that hurt babies and other children. It helps protect everyone's interests, so we're strongly in favor of that. And with that being said, I just want to ask you, as you're looking at these amendments, to think about the two stories that I'm just going to read to you. They're very brief, but this is what's at stake when you're considering these laws. The first statement comes from Katie Kelly. Her daughter, Hannah, died of SIDS in a licensed family daycare in Anoka County. Hannah was only 10 weeks old when she died, and this is what Katie asked me to share with you. The daycare provider placed Hannah to sleep on an adult bed on her stomach and not her back. The bed was covered with a comforter. Hannah was put to sleep in a back bedroom at the daycare. She was out of sight and sound of the daycare provider. Her daycare was overcrowded that day. Nobody monitored Hannah for hours. I support daycare licensing reform and the proposed changes in the law that require in-person checks on sleeping infants. This should be required, not just recommended. I also support the changes that increase the SIDS training the daycare providers will be required to get. If Hannah's daycare provider would have been required to check on Hannah every 15 minutes and had also been required to take the appropriate classes to prevent SIDS, quite possibly Hannah would still be here. And I did not hear any discussion today about an amendment that would change the monitoring of the sleeping infants from a requirement to a recommendation. But if any such amendment is proposed, perhaps it was and I missed it, we would support that it be required.
I think I remember at least seeing an amendment that would change the requirement to a suggest. I don't remember the word, but it's not quite a requirement.
And I've seen some of that proposed as well. And the last statement I just want to share with you is from Mallory Loftus. Her son Calvin was shaken to death by a daycare provider, and here's this what she wanted to share with you. My son Calvin was shaken to death by his daycare provider in a licensed family daycare in Hennepin County. Calvin was a beautiful, loving 5.5-month-old at the time of his death. He slept through the night since the time he was born and was a wonderful gift and companion to me and his family. I didn't realize until after he was killed that his provider was overcrowded and poorly supervised by an individual who appeared to all of us to be wonderful with children, but she completely lacked the skills, discipline, and training to perform her job. Many people don't realize that daycare providers don't naturally or innately know everything there is to know about caring for infants and children. Training should be mandatory before you can open and maintain a daycare license. Each of us should be distressed that infants are dying in daycare settings. We all need to stand together and say it should never happen, and we're willing to do whatever we can to make sure that daycares are safe. And that everyone who cares for our children have all of the skills necessary to provide the safest, most nurturing care possible. I support daycare licensing reform and the proposed changes in the law that require increased training on abusive head trauma, risk factors related to shaking infants, and supervising for safety. Maybe if the proposed reforms had been mandatory when my son was in daycare, things could have been different for Calvin. My life and the lives of Calvin's family will never be the same as a result of his death. No parent should have to go through the trauma and devastation I've suffered. Passing the daycare licensing reform legislation will, in my opinion, provide many opportunities to keep babies safe and allow them to grow and show their full potential to their parents and the world. Thank you. And so I just want to encourage all of you, as you're looking at these proposed reforms, to keep the babies in mind, because that's who the statutes are really designed to protect.
So you wouldn't, I checked it out, and it was an A13 from required to our encourage to, so you would not prefer that amendment.
We prefer required.
Okay, thank you. And state your name, and then go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Carla Skapansky, and I'm a family child care provider in Sauk Rapids. There are roughly 11,000 licensed in-home child care providers in Minnesota, and we are often the first or only choice for care throughout the state. I want to thank DHS and Representative Mullery for working with stakeholders to address these issues that are very important to family child care and to put focus on proposals which will have an impact on children's safety. Several of the amendments that will be proposed were developed after hours of discussion with DHS and many providers throughout the whole entire state of Minnesota. There is a diverse range of opinions about the direction to go, and so as the committee deliberates about the proposals before you, I would just ask that you keep in mind a couple guiding principles. First, engaging providers, licensors, and parents about child safety and safe infant sleep is vital. We are already seeing the benefit of this, as countless meetings with the department, news stories, and local works seems to have had an impact on the tragic trend of increased infant death in family child care. We have the tools in our toolbox. Clearly, education about the enforcement of current regulations is most effective strategy for supporting child safety. For example, supervising sleeping infants at regular intervals is critically important and should be part of any safe sleep. The sleep sacks, I don't know how much we support that, because when you look at the sleep sacks, that's something that you're going to have to find out in public. And when you start asking us to get things that we can't afford, that you have to purchase, it's over and above. But I personally have questions also about how enforceable the current proposal is and the impact it would have on all the children that I care for. Second, training and professional development needs to be affordable, accessible, and relevant to whenever possible, designed with the providers. I can certainly work with the training requirements included in the bill, but they need to be accompanied by the resources that the governor has provided in his budget. We can't afford it. And for the record, I am very supportive of the provisions included in this bill that improve some of the child care assistance issues. Finally, proposals for dealing with child safety should actually address child safety. Representative Fritz's proposal regarding sleep position is one example. I also like the amendment, which clarifies that no items except pacifiers may be in cribs, and further discussion about swaddling and sleep sacks are certainly warranted. While parents should have access to information about whether a provider holds liability insurance, requiring providers to hold it will not prevent infants from dying in our care. I truly appreciate your time for working with us. We place great value on the commitment to continue working together and going forward, because that is the only way to ensure the best quality environment for children. Thank you.
Thank you. I just wanted to clarify one more. On the sleep sacks,
when we're talking about sleep sacks, these are things that we have to get out and we have to go out and purchase them. And how many are we going to need in our child base, in our child care? Several of them.
So
for each one of our infants we have, and then our public is something that we have to purchase out in the public. Again, another cost put on to the provider on top of the fact we have to pay for the. This is not something that we're going to get handed to us.
So let me. I'm just trying to clarify. You don't oppose the sleep sack exception. You're just saying that that's not practical for a lot of people. So are you? And I'm.
Yeah,
I have
you
to
want
sort
to
this all
going?
Out, but. As I, it sounds to me like you want the blanket swaddling.
Oh, you know what? The only thing that should be in the crib with the baby, I believe.
So you're not for the blanket swaddling. So you're all in agreement kind of on that.
I think we all should sit down and be in agreement on everything is what we should do.
True. Boy, would that help us.
You know what? It would be nice if people would all come to the table at the same time and at least listen to each other. Because we really are on the same road. We all got the same common goal. We just all got to sit down and hash it out together as a group.
We have about 30 seconds left for this room. Can everybody that's been involved in this, can you be available to member? We're going to be on the floor in about an hour. It would really be nice if people could narrow all the issues and then be available to the members of the committee to discuss all of their questions with them so that they can get every question asked and answered. Is that possible for all of the, I know there's, can you?
We don't have any problems with that. We were asked to do that at the very beginning, to sit down and talk to people and discuss this, but people would not sit down and talk
and
with us.
So, Mr. Kerber, you will do it, and your staff, and Ms. Cunningham and Chase, I think it was. And if there's anybody else that wants to get in on it, but members, I'm sure, have a lot of questions. We we're a minute over what our time is in this room, so.
Mr. Chair, could you clarify? I really like to spend my time on the floor listening to the bills that are being debated and whatever our work is, and I do have taxes. The tax omnibus bill is coming out. Would you clarify, will members have a chance to ask questions at our hearing tomorrow morning?
No, that was just going to be voting.
So when are the members going to have a chance to ask questions? We're not having any committee time for that?
Well, if we vote on every amendment, that'll take up the hour that we have for the hearing. I didn't realize that testimony was going to take 2.5 hours. And so it's kind of a problem that way. But I don't understand. So you can't ask questions during the.
There are other members that have said that they have questions, and you're leaving no time for questions.
Well,
I think that's a problem.
Well, if we're not going to have, if the problem is there's like 21 amendments or something. If people want to start roll calling, it's going to take up forever. In that hour that we have, if we're just going to not spend much time on amendments, then we could do the first half hour on questions, things like that.
Mr. Chair, perhaps, I spoke to you about this before, but this is obviously a big issue and not one that we want to rush through. So perhaps tomorrow when it's officially before us, we could table the bill, work on it over the summer.
Representative Franson, that's not going to happen, as I told you Friday. There's some of these things that we want to put into get them through. This is a big safety issue. If the committee decides to table it, they can do that. I'm going to suggest that they don't. I think that Representative Huntley asked us to look at these issues and to give him a recommendation. So that's what I intend to do.
Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Are the questions coming around each of the amendments? I would assume that the amendments were drafted because those are the issues that you wanted to talk about. Would we be able to have the discussion around each of the amendments tomorrow, and would that be satisfactory for having the opportunity to discuss your concerns?
Well, I'm not sure, Mr. Chair, and Representative Lane, how many providers are going to be able to come back tomorrow. This is an issue that affects, of course, over 11,000 providers, and we certainly don't want to just...
Representative Franzen, I realize that, and there's no reason that people can't ask them between now and tomorrow. This happens all of the time. I don't know why we can't do it that way. It's constant.
I for one, Mr. Chair, like just things being on the record so we can go back. Personally, I mean, instead of the he said, she said, I didn't say that. That's not what I meant. It's just me, but...
Well, as I said, if we can establish we're not going to be roll calling amendments, then we've got probably a half hour that we could do that morning. You know whether you're going to want to roll call amendments?
Mr. Chair, I'm still a little confused. We went through each of the amendments and we had some conversation around each one. Now, I would be assuming that tomorrow we would have discussion around the amendments at the table, and you'd have an opportunity to ask your questions and express your concerns at the table. Is that not what you're thinking?
I guess I had questions. And I didn't ask any questions, even though I've got a ton of questions, and mainly for testifiers. And now I'm not going to get an opportunity to do that. And that's what my frustration is.
Mr. Chair,
well,
also,
we are going to get this out, and we only have a certain amount of time.
I gather that, but that, I had some.
And I know you had questions, and most of us would not have a problem asking questions of the people the rest of today. It sounds to me like there's not going to be very, I mean, the people involved, as you think. It sounds to me like you're pretty close on almost every issue. You're not very far, and there can. It sounds to me like there's a few definite issues where you disagree, and one side, you can give a short statement as to why you disagree on each. Isn't that correct? Am I wrong? It certainly sounded that way to me. Isn't that correct? Am I wrong? It certainly sounded that way to me.
I still have disagreement.
So,
Mr. Chair, in working on a bill, it's not only the amendments, it's also the bill itself. And the bill hasn't been introduced. It isn't part of the possession of the committee. And when the department went through the bill, there were questions, as it was being explained, that came up for all of the different members, and we were not allowed to ask at that time, and we were told we were going to have another opportunity.
I thought there'd be time.
Yeah, and so I just want to register with you that you're right. It is important, and it shouldn't be rushed, but here we are at the very end. This section, this information should have been brought to this committee earlier on. There were quite a number of committee hearings that were canceled, and we should have taken it up then rather than having this last
Meyer,
minute.
That's not my fault. I found about this
unfortunately,
on Friday afternoon about 4:30.
Yeah, and but as a committee, I do want to register that it's very unfortunate that we're not even being able to ask questions on the bill itself, and I don't know what's on the mind of my fellow
Myra,
representatives.
If it wasn't for me insisting on this hearing, it wouldn't be happening.
So the fact that the committee is getting to hear this is because I insisted on having a hearing here. So I've been doing everything possible to get this committee to have a hearing. We went an hour over the time. We're trying to get everything in front of this committee. We tried to get testimony from all the providers. Representative Meyer, I am offended that you're saying we're rushing this in any way, because
I appreciate
it would not be happening if I hadn't insisted in it. We've gone, I don't know any way we could have more time involved on this.
Mr. Chair, I appreciate that you spoke up for this committee. That we should have been able to see that. And that was wise on your part. But then, just as far as the public knows, it is going through this committee, and we're going to be voting on it. And it would be appropriate for us to have adequate time to just ask some of those basic questions. I am glad that you saw that this is something that should have come under our purview. And that's good. That's very good. But now it is under our look. We're supposed to be looking at it. And I believe we should have time to ask questions.
Well, Representative Mayor, we'll have a half hour questions then in the morning. And
Mr. Chair, I don't know if other people's schedule, but my schedule shows that we would have some time to continue the hearing a little bit longer than an hour and a half, and suggesting that whatever we go through the we introduce the bill properly and then go through it quickly and have opportunity to ask questions and then go through the amendments in sort of a normal fashion, if we can take a little bit longer.
I'll check in the morning, but my understanding is that it isn't available, but I'm not sure why. I can't remember.
Find a different room.
Anyhow, we'll have a half hour questions in the morning, and by then it should. So is there a lot of questions as to whether we should be doing anything on this? Because it sounds to me like all of the testimony from everybody is that we should be doing a lot of this. They just disagree on a few points as to what it is. So when you say you have a lot of questions on the basic bill, I'm missing something, or else you're not in agreement with all the testifiers. Because it seems to me like most of the testifiers think something, they seem to be in agreement, something should be done. And there's a few distinctions as to what that should be.
Mr. Chair, I appreciate the testifiers are agreeing with one another, and that makes our job more easy. But I think that there are questions that the committee has, and I think it is appropriate that we have time tomorrow morning to vent those questions. And Representative, I appreciate your encouragement that we go to an hour and a half tomorrow morning, make sure that we can cover these issues. 2 hours. Thank you. Yes, even better. So I think all has been said right now, and I think we should adjourn and get over the floor and meet tomorrow morning and see how many questions. And members, if we could just be as concise as possible on those questions, that'd be great.
And basically, it should be, yes, and if you have questions as to why we should be doing or something off of all the testimony, then I guess we'll take them. But it seems like all of the people involved seem to be in agreement except on a few specific things. And there's some strong disagreement on a few things. But we were sent these to get them out, and so we're going to take a vote on it tomorrow. And let Representative Huntley know later tomorrow what the vote is and what it is. So, and I still encourage you to talk to the people who have everyone here has the testified said they would be available. So I've been here 17 years, and that's the way we've always taken care of this in the past, and I don't see why we can't do it the same way right now.
Working deals under the table.
Representative Franson, I will ask you to remove that or to retract that comment, because it is definitely out of line, and
that could be, I won't go further with what could be done with that. So I don't expect that kind of comment.
Sorry, it wasn't meant to be inappropriate.
It was very inappropriate.
Do we need a motion to adjourn?
Since it's, well, we'll make adjourn. You don't, you never need a motion to adjourn. The chair can adjourn, but okay. On an informal meeting, sometimes we just turn off the thing. Oh, okay. Okay, so, okay, I did adjourn.